So Ruth chapter 2 and chapter 3. Now, look, you've got your Bibles open, you'll be following along. However, because this is such a narrative of a story, if you want, I don't mind if you just want to actually sit there and let me tell you the story before Soph comes and preaches it, if that works for you. Now, Naomi had a relative on her husband's side, a man of standing from the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, "Let me go to the fields and pick up the leftover grain behind anyone in whose eyes I find favor." Naomi said to her, "Go ahead, my daughter." So she went out, entered a field, and began to glean behind the harvesters. As it turned out, she was working in a field belonging to Boaz, who was from the clan of Elimelech. Just then, Boaz arrived from Bethlehem and greeted the harvesters. "The Lord be with you." "The Lord bless you," they answered. Boaz asked the overseer of his harvesters, "Who does that young woman belong to?" The overseer replied, "She's the Moabite who came back from Moab with Naomi. She said, 'Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves behind the harvesters.' She came into the field and has remained here from morning till now, except for a short rest in the shelter." So Boaz said to Ruth, "My daughter, listen to me. Don't go and glean in another field and don't go away from here. Stay here with the women who work for me. Watch the field where the men are harvesting and follow along after the women. I've told the men not to lay a hand on you. And whenever you are thirsty, go and get a drink from the water jars the men have filled." At this, she bowed down with her face to the ground. She asked him, "Why have I found such favor in your eyes that you noticed me, a foreigner?" And Boaz replied, "I've been told all about what you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, how you left your father and mother and your homeland and came to live with a people you did not know before. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you've come to take refuge. May I continue to find favor in your eyes, my Lord," she said. "You have put me at ease by speaking kindly to your servant, though I do not have the standing of one of your servants." At mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come over here, have some bread and dip it in the wine vinegar." When she sat down with the harvesters, she offered her some roasted grain. He offered her some roasted grain. She ate all she wanted and had some left over. As she got up to glean, Boaz gave orders to his men, "Let her gather among the sheaves and don't reprimand her. Even pull out some stalks for her from the bundles and leave them for her to pick up and don't rebuke her." So Ruth gleaned in the field until evening. Then she threshed the barley she had gathered, and it amounted to about an ephah. She carried it back to town, and her mother-in-law saw how much she had gathered. Ruth also brought out and gave her what she had left over after she had eaten enough. Her mother-in-law asked her, "Where did you glean today? Where did you work? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." Then Ruth told her mother-in-law about the one at whose place she had been working. "The name of the man I worked with today is Boaz," she said. "The Lord bless him," Naomi said to her daughter-in-law. "He's not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead." She added, "That man is our close relative. He's one of our guardian redeemers." Then Ruth, the Moabite, said, "He even said to me, 'Stay with my workers until they finish harvesting all my grain.'" Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It will be good for you, my daughter, to go with the women who work for him, because in someone else's field you might be harmed." So Ruth stayed close to the women of Boaz to glean until the barley and wheat harvests were finished, and she lived with her mother-in-law. One day, Ruth's mother-in-law, Naomi, said to her, "My daughter, I must find a home for you where you will be well provided for. Now, Boaz, with whose women you have worked, is a relative of ours. Tonight, he'll be winnowing barley on the threshing floor. wash, put on perfume, get dressed in your best clothes, then go down to the threshing floor, but don't let him know you're there until he's finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, note the place where he's lying, then go and uncover his feet and lie down. He'll tell you what to do. I'll do whatever you say, Ruth answered. So she went down to the threshing floor and did everything her mother-in-law told her to do. When Boaz had finished eating and drinking and was in good spirits, he went over to lie down at the far end of the grain pile. Ruth approached quietly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. In the middle of the night, something startled the man. He turned, and there was a woman lying at his feet. "Who are you?" he asked. "I'm your servant Ruth," she said. "Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a guardian redeemer of our family." "The Lord bless you, my daughter," he replied. "This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. You've not run after the younger men, whether rich or poor, and now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you all you ask. All the people of my town know that you are a woman of noble character. Although it's true that I am a guardian redeemer of our family, there is another who's more closely related than I. Stay here for the night, and in the morning, if he wants to do his duty as your guardian redeemer, good, let him redeem you. But if he's not willing, as surely as the Lord lives, I will do it. Lie here until morning." So she lay at his feet until morning, but got up before anyone could be recognized, and he said, "No one must know that a woman came to the threshing floor." He also said, "Bring me the shawl you are wearing and hold it out." When she did so, he poured into it 6 measures of barley and placed the bundle on her. Then he went back to town. When Ruth came to her mother-in-law, Naomi asked, "How did it go, my daughter?" Then she told her everything Boaz had done for her and added, "He gave me these 6 measures of barley, saying, 'Don't go back to your mother-in-law empty-handed.'" Then Naomi said, "Wait, my daughter, until you find out what happens, for the man will not rest until the matter is settled today."
Let me pray for us. Loving Father, thank you so much for your word, for the gift that it is to us. And thank you that you have given us your spirit so that we can understand your word. I pray, Lord, that you would be present with us by your spirit, teaching us and instructing us, opening our eyes, helping us to understand, and more importantly, to obey. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. I want to ask you who your favourite Disney princess is. You don't have to yell it out, but just have a think. When my kids were small, Mulan was the most popular Disney princess in our house, partly because it had a somewhat shy but surprisingly strong female lead for Jessica to identify with, and also enough martial arts so that Daniel would sit still and actually watch the whole movie with her, which was not true for any other Disney princess movie at the time. And Mulan is still one of my favourites. But it will probably surprise no one here to learn that my favourite Disney princess is actually Leia. And I mention that because the way that we tell the story of Ruth often ends up sounding like a fairy tale. Not so much a Disney princess, more a VeggieTales princess, but still some kind of Cinderella figure, just without the evil stepmother or stepsisters. And in the kind of Disney princess interpretation of Ruth, she's sort of poor and overlooked like Cinderella, until handsome Prince Boaz turns up, recognises her true worth, falls desperately in love with her, and won't stop until he makes her his wife, and then they live happily ever after. All the elements of a good fairy tale. But in the last few decades, there's been some people who end up telling the story of Ruth in ways that make her sound a lot more like Leia Organa, the kind of self-rescuing princess. And in that version of the story, or that interpretation of the story, Ruth is entirely in charge of her own destiny. She chooses to make a new life for herself in Israel. She provides for her own and Naomi's needs, and she selects a husband for herself and negotiates a marriage without any help from a husband or father, or really any males in the story. And I mentioned those two things, the kind of fairy tale version and the feminist icon version, because we have to be really careful when we're reading the Bible. The truth is that the cultures of the people in the Bible, these events that happened thousands and thousands of kilometres away from here and thousands of years ago in history, they're very different to the culture and to the society that we live in. And when we read back with our own perspectives and our own lenses, it's a bit like adding 2 and 2 and getting 22 instead of 2 and 2 and getting 4, or it can be a bit like that. And I think that's what happens sometimes with the Book of Ruth, because neither the Disney princess version nor the feminist icon version really do justice to the narrative, to what's recorded for us. What we have to do is try and set aside our own culture and our worldview and do our best to understand the events of the Book of Ruth the way that the people who experienced them would have understood them, because that's the people that God was communicating first. This was God's message to those people, for us, but to those people in the first place. And we need to hear that message for ourselves. And one of the best ways to do that, or one of the principles that we need to keep in mind, is to let the Bible interpret the Bible for us. I absolutely loved studying the Old Testament at Bible College, partly because I had just a brilliant lecturer. And Bill used to say to us over and over again, the key to understanding the Old Testament is you have to understand the law, the Torah, the first 5 books of the Bible. And he would make us study that in detail and say, through that lens, you can interpret the other parts, the narratives and the prophets. And I think if we look back at the laws of Israel, and you remember our Exodus series, you know, don't think about the laws as legalism, but think about the laws as God's way that he wanted his people to live in freedom, to live in his perfect, created design way. Then I think if we keep an eye on the law, then the Book of Ruth, stuff that frankly is pretty weird and wonderful, starts to make a bit more sense. And that's what we're going to do together this morning. We're going to try and read these middle chapters of the Book of Ruth with one eye on the Torah. And I want to warn you up front, it's not romantic. In fact, some parts of the story are weird and in fact quite disturbing from our perspective. But it's God's word and there is a message in it for us. And that message is summed up really well in the title of this series, Faithful Love. Because this story is a story of God's faithful love expressed through his people, in this case, Boaz, Ruth, and Naomi. So when Tim read chapters 2 and 3 to us, he picked up the story where Cedric left off last week. Naomi and Ruth have arrived back in Bethlehem, in Naomi's hometown, at the time of the barley harvest, which is the very first harvest of summer. So we're, you know, June or somewhere like that. And the big question is, how are they going to survive? Because they don't have husbands or children to support them. Naomi is older. We know from what she said in chapter 1 that she's through menopause. She's probably not well enough to work to support herself. They have land, but they weren't there to farm it. Nothing's been planted on it. The land's sitting empty. So, like, it's a survival issue. It's a starvation issue at this point. And Ruth takes the initiative and suggests to Naomi that she goes out to glean in someone's field. Now, gleaning was enshrined in Israel's laws as one of God's provisions for the poor and the marginalised. The people who, and that was like the poor, the widows, the orphans, the foreigners, the disabled, the people who were easy to exploit because they didn't have the normal protections in that society of health, wealth, husbands, fathers, brothers, clans, tribes. They don't have anyone to look out for them. And you can read about those laws in Leviticus 19 and 23 if you're interested. God specifically told the Israelites that when they were harvesting, they weren't allowed to harvest right to the edges of the field. And they weren't to go back and pick up the pieces of the harvest that kind of got dropped when they were making up the sheaves on the first go through the field. They weren't to pick all the grapes that fell off the vines or all the bits of fruit that fell off the trees in the orchard. Basically, God said to them, don't try and wring every last drop of profit out of your farmland or your orchards and your vineyards. But rather, you're to manage your households, run your veggie garden, conduct your agricultural business in a way that leaves some or makes some provision for the poor and the marginalised members in the community. Which I think is a principle worth considering as we think about our own households and business dealings. And gathering up all those leftovers after the harvest was called gleaning. If you were a gleaner, you worked a long day in the hot sun for relatively little reward. Historians tell us a good day's gleaning was about 2 kilos of grain. So imagine 2 kilos of barley or 2 kilos of wheat. It's enough grain for your daily bread, but not much else. But it did mean that the poor could survive physically. They weren't going to starve. And it also meant they could participate in the spiritual life of the nation because a grain offering was one of the offerings that you could bring to the Lord. So Ruth goes out to glean, and she happened to end up gleaning in the field of Boaz, who's introduced to us as Elimelech's relative, her father-in-law's relative, and a man of standing, an important and respected person in his community. And Boaz is clearly a really responsible landowner and employer. He's out there checking on the work of the harvest. And he's introduced to us greeting his workers. He's saying to them, "Yahweh, may Yahweh bless you." He's using the personal name of God to bless his workers, which is a way of just signaling to us, this is a man who knows and worships the covenant God. He's also clearly a man who knows his workers, because he looks out in the field and he immediately notices Ruth, who he doesn't know personally, the stranger. And he asks his manager, who is this woman? What's she doing here? And Ruth has apparently respectfully asked the foreman if she can glean. And he obviously knows the law and knows Boaz's respect for the law. And he's given her permission because he tells Boaz she's been hard at work all morning. But now the foreman repeats his request to Boaz because Boaz is the landowner. It's up to him to make the final decision. Boaz could say, no, no more, not happy, send her away. And Boaz's response is really interesting. He doesn't just say, sure, fine, no problem, she can glean. But he goes above and beyond. He makes it clear to all his employees, not just the foreman, but all of the harvesters, that he has given Ruth permission to gather the harvest along with the women, and that she is under his protection. They are not to harm her, which apparently was pretty common. You might get harmed in the field if someone comes up a couple of times in the story. Not to harm her. They're not even to rebuke her. Instead, he actually says to them, I want you to kind of accidentally on purpose start dropping some, like leave a lot on the ground so there's a lot for her to glean. And by doing that, Boaz is making sure that Ruth is going to be firstly safe and secondly really well provided for. And you can see how unusual that was in Ruth's response. She's so very grateful for his kindness that she actually bows down, she prostrates herself as a sign of deep respect and thankfulness. And Boaz does two more things to Ruth. When she does that, when she prostrates herself before him, he responds by blessing her. Boaz calls on Yahweh to bless Ruth for her faithfulness to him and to Naomi. All that you've done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, he says. How you left your father and your mother, your native land, you've come to a people that you did not know before. May the Lord repay you for what you've done, and a full reward be given to you by the Lord, by Yahweh, the God of Israel, under whose wings you've come to take refuge. Boaz looks at Ruth and he gets it. He understands why Ruth is in his field. He's not asking why she did the culturally nonsensical thing of following her mother-in-law back to Israel, which, as Cedric explained to us last week, Orpah did the normal thing, Ruth did the unusual thing. Boaz sees her faith and he understands that she's come to take refuge under God's wings. And I love that picture of God like a mother or father bird sheltering the little chicks under his wings. It's beautiful and tender. It's a picture of care and protection and comfort and belonging that comes up not just here but in the Psalms and in other places in the Old Testament as well. And what a beautiful way to bless a woman who has no husband or son, no father, no clan or tribe to protect her. He's telling her God is the one who is her protector and provider. And it's not just empty words or wishful thinking, because it's backed up by Boaz's actions. He's acting, expressing God's protection and care for Ruth, isn't he? So this is a genuine and a heartfelt blessing. And it touches Ruth very deeply. You can see her response in 2 verse 13. I've found favour in your eyes, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your servant, although I am not one of your servants. She's saying, I'm here working in your field, but I'm not part of a group that should expect your favour and kindness, but you've shown it anyway. Thank you. The other really meaningful thing that Boaz does is that he invites Ruth into community. He says she's to drink from the communal water jugs, and he invites her to come and join the harvesters for lunch. Now remember that Ruth is a Moabitess, not an Israelite, for all that she was married to an Israelite man. And the Jews have strict purity laws, but Boaz still invites her to sit and eat with them from the shared vessels, and he serves her a generous portion. He's treating her as a member of the community, not as an outsider or an enemy. And I imagine that it took a man of faith to recognize that Ruth was spiritually a member of God's people, you know, that she had the faith in Yahweh that was the true marker of an Israelite, not their ethnicity. But he saw that Ruth was spiritually a member of God's people, even though she wasn't an Israelite by birth. And it probably also took someone with his standing in the community to go and act on those spiritual insights, to challenge the status quo and to welcome Ruth into the life and the fellowship of the community. So when Ruth goes home after that first night and she tells Naomi what Boaz has done, Naomi says, "May Yahweh bless him. He has not stopped showing kindness to the living and the dead." And the word that Naomi is using to describe Boaz's actions is a really special word in Hebrew. It's the word chesed. And it's one of the most important and defining characteristics of God himself. In the book of Exodus, when God proclaims his name, when he describes his character to Moses, you know, he said that I am who I am, but that time when he says, I will go in front of you and I will say, I will proclaim my name. This is what he says, the Lord, and the capitals mean he's saying Yahweh, you know, the I am. The Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness, that's chesed number one, maintaining love, or chesed number two, to thousands, and forgiving wickedness, rebellion, and sin. It's two words, different words in English, but it's the same word in Hebrew. So it's obviously a really important aspect of God's character because God mentioned it twice. You know, he really emphasized it as a defining description of himself. Now, this passage, I think up here, is from the NIV, but if you're reading from a different translation, you might have a different word. It might say loving kindness or faithful love, which is where we got our title for the sermon series from, or covenant kindness. It kind of means love and kindness and faithfulness all smushed together. We don't just have one English word that covers that, which is why it ends up different in different translations. But you can see why God emphasizes it when he describes his character, because it's just the perfect description of the way God treats the Israelites, isn't it? Throughout the Old Testament, God makes promises, he makes a covenant with Israel, and he keeps those promises faithfully and lovingly. And Naomi recognizes that same attribute in Boaz, and she's asking their faithful, loving God to bless Boaz and to return that same kind of faithful love, that same kind of kindness to him. I wonder if you can just imagine Naomi waiting for Ruth's return at the end of that first day of gleaning. I wonder what you think she expected, what she hoped for, or what she feared. I doubt that she expected what actually happened, which was Ruth coming home absolutely laden with God's provision for their family. Remember, she had leftovers from lunch. She brought back her little halal snack pack of roasted grain to eat right away. And she had an ephah, which is about 13 kilograms of barley, giant sack of barley that she can barely carry, about seven times as much as the average day's gleanings. Do you remember what Naomi had told the women of Bethlehem when she first arrived home in chapter 1? I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. And God is filling Naomi again, and he's doing it in a really significant way. When Ruth tells Naomi that she had been in Boaz's gleaning field, Naomi says to Ruth, "That man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers." And again, Naomi's pointing back to a provision in the covenant. Gleaning wasn't the only way that God had provided for the vulnerable in Israel. The law also provided a system of kinsmen or guardian redeemers. If an Israelite became so desperately poor that they had to sell their land or even sell themselves into slavery in order to survive, then their relatives, their nearest male relative, brother, or if there's no brother, an uncle or a cousin, or whoever's the next of kin kind of thing, the law commands that person to act as a redeemer. Remember, to redeem is to buy back. You are to redeem that relative out of slavery or to redeem their land out of where it's been sold so that they're not lost and their livelihood is not lost. And when Naomi sees Ruth coming up the path with that big, huge sack of grain, and when she hears that God has led her into the fields of a guardian redeemer, these are really powerful responses from God himself in answer to Naomi's question, you know, her doubt, her lament, her bitter words in chapter 1. The truth is, Yahweh's hand is not against Naomi as she feared it was. He's not testifying against her as she thought he was. He has not left her empty. The Lord is still committed to her with faithful love, and he wants to bring her into fullness again. And how does he do that? Carolyn Custis James, in her really awesome book, The Gospel of Ruth, says this: more often than not, when we dust for God's fingerprints, we come up with the prints of one of his image bearers. God is expressing his faithful love to Naomi through his people, through her covenant relationships with those who love and serve Yahweh as he does, with her daughter-in-law Ruth, who had made that amazing covenant with her in Ruth chapter 1, and with her guardian redeemer, with Boaz, who has a covenant with Yahweh that includes his relatives, you know, his family. Well, Boaz's actions must have gotten Naomi thinking. And so that at the start of chapter 3, she comes back to Ruth with a proposal. Ruth, shouldn't I seek rest for you? And if you remember back to chapter 1, when Naomi had tried to send Orpah and Ruth back to Moab, you know, they're on the border between Moab and Israel, and Naomi's like, go back, my daughters. Go back and find, may Yahweh help you find rest in the home of another husband. And now, you know, months later, because we're now in chapter 3 at the end of the harvest, so we've gone from June, you know, we're maybe at September or something, Naomi wants to be part of Ruth finding and enjoying that blessing that she's been asking God for her daughters-in-law. And what Naomi tells Ruth to do is to get washed and dressed, anoint herself with oil, so, you know, lotion and perfume, and then head down to the threshing floor where she'll find Boaz and his workers. Apparently it was customary for the men to sleep at the threshing floor to guard the grain until it could be put into more secure storage. And those nights at the threshing floor turned into kind of end of harvest parties. Like this was the good time in Israel. You know, all the harvest is in, there's plenty of food. You know, the first vats of wine are being opened that, you know, we finished making. It's a really good time. But the preparations that Naomi tells Ruth to make, anointing with oil and putting on new clothes, are actions that you would take to signify the end of a period of mourning. And it's possible that what she's saying to Ruth is, take off your widow's clothing and dress in a way that indicates you're single again. So much like saying, you know, are you ready to take off your wedding ring if you're a modern-day widow? Are you ready to get back out there again? And Naomi tells Ruth to go to the party, but to keep her cloak on so that no one will know who she is, and presumably so that no one notices her new available status, until the crucial moment. And what she's to do is to take careful note of where Boaz makes his bed to the night. And when Boaz and everyone else is soundly asleep, Ruth should sneak over to Boaz, uncover his feet and lie down at his feet. And then Naomi says, with, I think, pretty profound understatement, when he wakes up, I think he'll tell you what to do. Oh, good. Now, I'll keep it PG, but the Hebrew is not, all right? So the language that Naomi uses in her instructions is really highly suggestive. She manages to cram most Hebrew euphemisms for sex into about 4 verses. So Ruth is out, heading out unaccompanied to the harvest party, which is basically an ancient Jewish singles night. Good Hebrew men wore robes, not trousers, so uncovering Boaz's feet isn't so much pulling his socks off as as lifting up his skirts, which is potentially a little bit more risque. The Hebrew doesn't say uncover his feet because there's actually no Hebrew word for feet. There's a word for everything from the top of your thigh to the tips of your toes. So it's not entirely clear precisely what she's being asked to uncover or where she's being asked to lie down. Lying down is problematic because in the Old Testament, when a man lies down with a woman, the normal result is pregnancy, as in Jacob lay with Leah and she conceived and gave birth to a son. And just to round things out, Naomi manages to squeeze the word no into her instructions several times, and the main thing a man knew in the Old Testament was his wife, with the same results as lying down. So, if Naomi and Ruth were here today and we were listening to this conversation, what we would hear Naomi tell Ruth is something like, I want you to go to the party and sleep with Boaz. And nobody over the age of 12 is going to think she means a nap, okay? Nobody's thinking that. And I think we have to ask, why is Naomi suggesting something that seems, frankly, pretty morally questionable? We'd all be concerned if this was a biblical dating advice Livewire is teaching, right? Like, there would be words. It would be a problem. And so we need to unpack that a bit. We don't get a lot of detail about marriage negotiations in the Bible, but whenever it happens, it seems to be fathers negotiating marriages for their daughters, either with the father of the groom or with the groom himself or the father's representatives. Naomi's acting as Ruth's mother here, but she doesn't have a husband to act as Ruth's father, and Ruth doesn't have a brother or an uncle or any other male relative who can speak for her, so the women have to do the marriage negotiations themselves. And if you've been watching Emma or Pride and Prejudice or even Bridgerton lately, think about how much power to negotiate a marriage women had even in our society 300 years ago when marriage negotiations happened between fathers and grooms. What's your power, right, in that situation? It's seduction, it's entrapment. That's how you negotiate a marriage if there's no male relative to speak for you. And I think that's what's going on here. But keep in mind that the goal of Naomi's instructions, it's not an affair, it's not a one-night stand. She's not trying to set up some kind of illicit encounter, but she's trying to use the power that's available to the women to negotiate a marriage. When Naomi sends Ruth to Boaz at the threshing floor, chances are that Boaz already has a wife. There's a whole bunch of to-ing and fro-ing in chapter 4 about inheritances that implies Boaz already has other children. Maybe he's a widow, probably he's married. And from the point of view of that culture, if you're thinking marriage negotiations, Ruth doesn't have much to persuade a man like Boaz, you know, a wealthy, high-class, respected member of his community to marry her. She's a foreigner. She's destitute. There's no dowry coming with this marriage. She's been married before, and her marriage was infertile. In a 10-year period, she didn't have children. So she's not the best wife material if you're the Jewish matchmaker, right? But on the other hand, if you think about it more personally and not from that kind of strategic negotiation sense, she would be a wonderful addition to any household or extended family, wouldn't she? She's proved herself in the months that she spent in Bethlehem to be a woman of faith, to be a hard worker, to be a loyal and faithful daughter. And I think Naomi's plan is that Boaz will understand Ruth's extremely unsubtle non-verbal communication of clothing and feet uncovering and laying down. And he trusts that Boaz will recognise Ruth's true worth, that he'll consummate the relationship and take her home with him, and that she will be his husband, which it seems is all that's essential for a common law marriage, a de facto relationship, a concubinage, to be legitimised in Israel at that time. And that way, Naomi will have secured a home and a future for Ruth. Ruth will be provided for long term. And Ruth apparently agrees to Naomi's plan. She's doing the culturally, you know, she's using the cultural options that are available to her, and she goes off to the end of the harvest party. And she follows Naomi's instructions to the letter right up to the last point. Instead of waiting for Boaz to tell her what to do, she speaks. And when Boaz rolls over in the night and bumps into Ruth and is startled awake, he says, "Who are you?" And instead of just saying, "I'm Ruth," Ruth says, I'm Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over me because you are a redeemer. Which is Ruth asking Boaz to marry her. That's what spread your wings over me means. Your wings are the corner of your robe, and to spread your wings over someone is to bring them under your protection. Like all the times the psalmists talk about finding shelter under God's wings, it's also used by the prophets in the passages where it talks about Israel as Yahweh's bride. So it's a synonym for marriage, the real deal, not just being a concubine, which was a kind of second-class wife, without the full legal rights of marriage in Israel. But it's also a really significant statement in the context of Boaz and Ruth's relationship. When Boaz had blessed Ruth in chapter 2, remember that that's the words he used. He asked that she would find refuge under the wings of Yahweh. And when Ruth proposes to Boaz and says, spread your wings over me, she's saying, Boaz, be the answer to your own prayer. And Boaz's response is really fascinating. He interprets Ruth's proposal as an amazing act of faithful love, of the chesed that we talked about earlier. He says, this kindness, this chesed, is greater than your earlier kindness. Now, Ruth's earlier kindness was committing herself to Naomi and accompanying her back to, you know, leaving her family, accompanying her back to Israel, serving her for her, you know, gleaning a whole summer to provide for her, which to my way of thinking is a pretty substantial act of kindness. So how is Ruth's proposal to Boaz even more kind than that? In the Disney princess version of this story, what you get told is that Boaz is humbly grateful that Ruth chose him, because we get strong hints in the story that Boaz is an older man. He's Naomi's peer. He's not Ruth's peer. But picking the mature man over the younger men really doesn't seem like that great of a deal of kindness in the context of the story, when Boaz is like the wealthy landowner, the just and thoughtful employer, the wise elder. You know, Mrs. Bennet and Lady Bridgerton would be lining up to marry any one of their daughters off to him, you know, tomorrow. So it doesn't seem like pursuing him is super more kind than giving up everything to serve your mother-in-law. So how can we understand it? Well, if you go right back to Genesis 11 and Genesis 18, when God first made his covenant with the people of Israel, with Abraham, there were two main things in the covenant: heirs, sons, descendants, and land. God was going to make Abraham into a great nation, and he was going to give that great nation a land of their own. And when God rescued Abraham's descendants from Egypt and he renewed the covenant with them and he gave them the law that's the backdrop to this story, those two concerns, heirs and land, are reflected very deeply in the law. And they go a long way to explaining some laws that sound pretty weird to us now. So the kinsman redeemer law is one of those laws, and it's concerned primarily with making sure that the promised land stays with the people of Israel and that each tribe keeps their share of the land. You know, the Israelites' understanding of land was less like property ownership, the way we understand it, and more like Indigenous Australians' understanding of country, that they belong to this part of land. You know, they were responsible to steward it on behalf of God, not that the land belonged to them. So if an Israelite fell into poverty and sold their land, then the kinsman needed to buy the land back to ensure that it stayed in Israel and within the right tribe of Israel, because that was their inheritance. It was the gift of Yahweh. But there's another law that you know, is quite close or related, that's Levirate marriage or brother marriage, which relates to the other part of God's covenant with Israel, the whole idea of descendants or heirs. The Israelites' main spiritual concern was that their family line would survive and continue to be included in God's chosen people into the future. Remember that we're in the book of Judges, or the time of the Judges at this point. No one's been raised from the dead yet. There are no promises about resurrection. God hasn't revealed that to Israel yet in this point in their history. So for the people at the time of Ruth, how you lived forever, how you continued to be included in God's people, was all tied up in your family name being preserved, and that name was passed on through your sons and heirs. Heirs were their security and their insurance. So for an Israelite man to die without a son and for his family name to be lost from the records of Israel is a really, really weighty thing for them. And it was for this reason that the Jewish law included Levirate or brother marriage. God commanded that when a man died without children, his brother should marry his widow and their children would be considered the children of the dead brother, so that his widow would be provided for and so that his family line, his name, would be preserved in the records of Israel. Now, in this story, the family of Elimelech has two problems. Problem one, they're about to lose their land. We learn in chapter 4 that Naomi's selling her land to provide for herself. So Elimelech's land is about to pass out of the family and the clan unless a guardian redeemer should buy it. But even if a guardian redeemer does purchase Elimelech's land from Naomi, that's only going to redeem the land. It won't redeem Elimelech's line because problem number two, there are no male heirs. Elimelech has died, Mahlon and Chilion have not died, Orpah and Ruth don't have any children. And this is the more serious problem. Elimelech's land can be redeemed and that will provide for Naomi and Ruth in their lifetimes. But it won't save this family in the long term. Their name will still die out from Israel. So it's a really, like it's an existential threat to the family of Elimelech. And when Ruth comes to Boaz and says, marry me because you are a redeemer, what she's saying is, marry me so that this family can be redeemed. She's bringing together Levirate marriage and the guardian redeemer aspects of redemption by offering herself to Boaz, the guardian redeemer, in marriage. And it seems that her primary concern in marrying Boaz isn't her own welfare, it's redeeming the family of her dead husband. I love this quote from David Ulrich. Naomi wanted a husband for Ruth. Ruth wanted a child for Naomi. And here was the embodiment of covenantal faithfulness, of chesed, that showed Ruth to be a true Israelite. Because of her faith in Yahweh, she acted on behalf of the less fortunate. You know, we think about Ruth as the less fortunate, but she acted on behalf of the spiritually less fortunate. If her first kindness was staying with Naomi, her second kindness was marrying that man who could provide the heir. Ruth married for neither love nor money, but familial well-being. Now, I want you to stop and think about that for a minute. Ruth's first marriage lasted 10 years and no children were born for that marriage, and it ended in premature widowhood. And here she is coming to a probably much older man, offering herself in marriage so that their union can produce sons and heirs. She's basically saying to Boaz, we can redeem that family together. But in order to do that, she's making herself vulnerable all over again to the pain of childlessness and the pain of another widowhood. But it's the only way. Boaz might be the kinsman redeemer, but without Ruth's willingness to enter into Levirate marriage, this would be the end of the road for Elimelech's family. And it is another incredible act of faithful love, just like that decision to go back to Israel with Naomi. And it's grounded in her faith in Yahweh. Like, what else could it be? Ruth is staking everything on her faith in Yahweh's ability to enable her to conceive, to bring fruitfulness out of barrenness, to bring life out of death. And it's no wonder in the face of that, that Boaz says this act is greater than the first. He says literally in the Hebrew that Ruth is doing chesed. She's showing faithful love to the family of Elimelech, reflecting God's faithful love to them. And that kind of covenant keeping requires courageous faith, and Boaz recognizes that. The two things that amaze him about Ruth are her faithful love and her courage. You might remember that when we first met Boaz in chapter 2, verse 1, he's introduced as a man of standing. And Boaz uses the exact same language to describe Ruth when he responds to her proposal in chapter 3. Now, most of our modern translations obscure that. It's identical language in Hebrew, but, you know, for whatever reason, that's not reflected. ESV is one of the few, and I've got it up on the screen there. Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And then Boaz says to Ruth, all my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman. But I want to tell you, worthy is actually a really wimpy translation. In the book of Judges, which is the same time period as the book of Ruth, the most common translation of this phrase is warrior, or man of valor, or if you go to the King James, mighty man of valor, or mighty warrior. You know, when the angel turns up and greets Gideon, greetings, mighty warrior, this is what he's saying. And Joanna Boss, in her commentary, says, Boaz calls her a woman of worth, and in doing so uses the very same words by which he himself was described in chapter 2 and Ishmael. Valiant might convey the most accurately what the Hebrew intends here. Ruth is valiant in her choices, which are not made because others dictate them to her. She knows what it means to have allied herself to the God of the Presence, the God of Israel, and it involves what Paul centuries later will call the freedom to serve one another in love. Boaz is deeply moved by Ruth's faithful love and by her courage. And as a man who's obviously also deeply committed to Yahweh and to his covenant, how can he not respond to that? But there's an obstacle. Boaz is not the closest guardian redeemer. There is another. And so Boaz can't just go ahead and take Ruth as his wife that night. And if you think about it, Ruth's in an incredibly vulnerable position, which a lot of men, then and now, if you've been watching the news for the last few weeks, would have taken advantage of. But he doesn't act to exploit her. He acts in ways that protect both her safety and her reputation. He doesn't shame or reject her for her bold request. He honours her courageous faith and the faithful love that motivated it. And then as a male relative, as a guardian redeemer, he steps up to join Ruth and to play his part in the redemption of Elimelech's family. And so he's honest with her. He tells her there's another guardian redeemer. He doesn't let her reputation be sullied so that she would be free to marry the other guardian redeemer. Boaz is kind of putting his own interests aside. You know, if the goal of redemption is best served by him being the male relative who steps in as like father or brother and negotiates Ruth's marriage to someone else, then he'll play that role. But if the redemption is best served by marrying her himself, then he will play that role wholeheartedly as well. And Boaz reflects the faithful love of his God in that way. I want to just spend a few moments as we close thinking together about what it means for us to live out that kind of courageous, faithful love in our lives. Because we too are part of God's people, we also have been redeemed and brought into a covenant with him. We stand on that covenant that Yahweh had with Israel, but we also are part of the new covenant in Jesus' blood. And we have a responsibility. You know, old covenant or new covenant, it's God's faithful love that's at the heart of it. And we have a responsibility to live in ways that reflect that faithful love. And what stands out to me, what's truly striking to me about the book of Ruth, is that the main place faithful love is worked out is in the mundane realities of everyday life. Naomi, Ruth, and Boaz aren't showing their faithfulness to God by doing all the dramatic things for God that are recorded in the book of Judges. Your same time period, right? But Boaz and Ruth and Naomi aren't out. They're not fighting battles. They're not chopping down idols. They're not conquering oppressors. They're not dying for their faith. They're not even starting some amazing new ministry. You know, Boaz didn't start a program to care for all the widows in Israel, or, you know, Ruth didn't go and start to try and save all of Moab, you know, and work out some evangelism strategy. They're just approaching normal life from the perspective of God's faithful love. Not that there's anything wrong with the big things, but it starts in everyday life. And we can see in this story how that affects the way they conduct their business and the way they manage their households and the way they negotiate all their relationships. Mother Teresa famously said, "We can't all do great things, but we can all do small things with great love." And I think we see that here, don't we? Naomi and Ruth and Boaz understand that God has redeemed them, that he's brought them into covenant relationship with himself, that he is faithfully loving them. And they're committed to living in a way that reflects that reality. And their actions really only make sense against the backdrop of God's faithful love to them. It's only because of him, because they really trust that he's got them, you know, he's holding them. Because of their trust in him, they're able to extend that faithful love to others so that they too can be redeemed and enjoy a covenant relationship with God. I quoted Carolyn Custis James earlier, and I just want to go back and say that again. More often than not, when we dust for God's fingerprints, then we come up with the prints of one of his image bearers. And I want to leave that challenge with us. How are your fingerprints? How are your fingers leaving fingerprints of God's faithful, redeeming loves in the life of others? Especially the people that you do life with, whether that's family, roommates, co-workers, neighbours, friends, all the people that God has brought you into relationship with. How are your fingers leaving fingerprints of God's faithful, redeeming love in the lives of others? Don's going to come up and the band's going to lead us in singing Good, Good Father. And I want to really ask you to lean into that, just to reflect on that word, those words. As I said to you, it's only as we trust in the faithful, redeeming love of God that we're able to live that out, to leave those fingerprints on the hearts of others.